have the same free speech rights as the rest of us? Writing, yes, they do. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Haiti, current challenges to grassroots movements, and more. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shamuizo Mentali. The music in the background is Can Be La by Mozique. In the past few years, negative developments on the political, economic, and environmental fronts have impacted Haiti severely. To mention just two major issues, since the July 7, 2021 assassination of the country's president, Jovenel Moïse, the country has been ruled by an unelected transitional presidential council. And well-armed gangs have controlled large areas, forcing over 1 million people to be internally displaced. Today, the show will focus on these and other challenges affecting grassroots movements in Haiti with activist Melina Elise Chalier, who's a member of Nous Pas Dormir, which means We Aren't Sleeping, and she's based in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Melina Elise Chalier unpacks the current challenges to grassroots mass movements mobilization efforts, such as the internal and external forces behind the well-armed gangs controlling the streets and towns, the role of the U.S. and other external governments and international institutions now and historically in blocking positive change, and more. Melina Elise Chalier also details the work and history of grassroots movements in Haiti. Here is my recent conversation with Melina Elise Chalier. Melina Elise Chalier, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mwiza. Thank you. Thanks for having me back. And thank you for everyone who's going to be listening.
Thanks again. Really value the information that you would be giving to us, and also giving us the nuances of the issues in Haiti. I wanted to just, before we get into deep into the discussion, if you could talk in brief a summary of the importance of grassroots movements historically in Haiti.
Well, Haiti has always been a country where information and communication and the truth about what's happening, the affair of the states, what's happening in the country, has been kept hidden or falsified by the elites, by the government. So grassroots movements in Haiti, the first importance that they have is bringing the truth to the people, and then organizing and mobilizing and keeping the spirit of the country alive by allowing people, peasants, mostly back in the days, and more in the huge cities, the big cities, keeping the demands of the population, keeping human rights in the forefront of the demands towards the government, and really being a voice for the people. Because a lot of the time in countries like Haiti, where there is a lot of poverty, a lot of corruption, and a lot of impunity, you would find that most of the population is kept without education, without access to the basics, and without a voice. They don't have their say in the politics. They don't have their say in how the country is run. And oftentimes they are referred to in Haiti as people that are outsiders, you know? So grassroots movements have always given a voice to the people of Haiti, to the poor of the poor, and to the ones who are left out.
And could one say that even the one of the biggest achievements, or the biggest achievement in historically of grassroots movement, was Haiti's independence?
Yes, well, back in the day. Yeah, that was the first grassroots movement with the Maroons community, and the fact that they were able to spread the word about liberty, the word about freedom, the word about people, any human being a human, you know, and the right for human beings to live freely and with decency and with dignity. That was the first and most successful grassroots movement in Haiti.
And of course, that's way back in 1804. But the movement
way back in 1804. But before we got to the 1804, it was actively 11, 12 years of working actively towards that. And even before that, we can say it was 100 of years in the making, because from the day that the slavery trade started, from the day that the slave trade started, there's always been Maroons community. So there's always been human beings who got into the colony and said that I am a human person, I am not a slave, and they took it to the mountains and they built the communities. And the word about those communities living freely, living with dignity, and living with respect, it spread out in the colony. So it took hundreds of years before we got to the independence. But the grassroots movement, if we may call it that way, the Maroons and all of the other freed people that were working towards the abolishment of slavery and towards the independence, they were tirelessly working at it. And the most well-known is the fight toward the independence. But Haiti's history, from when it was the colony of Saint-Domingue, it's always been paved with revolts from the slaves, you know, different outbursts of trying to reach their freedom until we got to the independence of Haiti.
And then we fast forward to the 20th century. We have also the major election, the rise of Aristides and Lavalas in 1990. One could also say that was another major grassroots movement, at least initially.
Well, even before that, Muiza, even before getting there, because remember, before Aristide arrived to power, there was a dictatorship in Haiti. It was grassroots movements from the Haitian people, from the Haitian diaspora, demands from those grassroots movements, from those small organizations, those peasant organizations, workers' organizations, that led towards the end of the dictatorship. And those same grassroots movements, and what was very important at the time, that I must say, the women movement. There was a lot of women organization that led to the end of the dictatorship and after that to the election of Aristide. So Haiti has always been very big on grassroots movements, and women have always had a very powerful voice in the grassroots movements.
Again, that's Valina Elise Chalier. She's an activist and member of Non Pap Domi, which means we aren't sleeping. And she's talking to us directly from Port-au-Prince and Haiti. And we're looking at Haiti's grassroots movements and the current challenges and other issues affecting the grassroots movements. But we wanted to start really taking a historical, so we have a more of a deeper understanding of what's happening. As you said, this movement has been ongoing in the country. And as we talk about, when people talk about what's going on in Haiti, of course, we have the security issues. But I wanted to touch on some of the things which movements are doing in this current atmosphere, which we don't hear about, whether it's the corporate media and others don't talk about. But what are some of the things, the achievements, even within these, as you're facing security challenges, what are some of the things that are going on on the ground?
as we are facing the insecurity and the gang violence and the gang control territory, grassroots movements in Haiti had to reinvent themselves. Grassroots movements had to move a lot into working online, on social media, on the meeting platforms, whether it is Zoom, whether it's Teams or Google Meet. Those grassroots had to reinvent themselves, and they had to find ways of becoming much more quiet about what they are doing. So mobilizing, organizing still in the neighborhoods, but being much more careful about what we are doing. So what we have seen in the past years are the women's organizations really doing wonderful working with the advantages of social media, of videos, of radio. You see, we have been seeing many of the times even play that they would use to put the lessons in perspective, whether it is because we are in that day of abortion rights, so they would turn that into a mini series on TV that plays on the different social media platforms, that plays on local TV. We are hearing more and more ads on the radios or infomercials, or we are hearing more and more podcasts about what's happening. So a lot of the grassroots organizations, like the one I am from, NUPAP Domi, we launched a citizens education program. So we do that in the schools. We work a lot with the teenagers, and we work a lot with videos, with the radio, with everything that does not demand for us to be present in the streets or to go directly into the gang control areas. So now what we do, we produce videos about our trainings, we produce videos about the anti-corruption, what can you do to mobilize against corruption, against impunity, against insecurity, and those videos, we send them directly to the communities that we used to work with. We mobilize a lot in the schools, so whenever there is schools, we're always present with our training. So we had to reinvent ourselves, and we had to learn how to be as efficient in person as we are in virtual. So we had to really embrace that virtual world and make it become our own, because you cannot move freely on the territory. And also because a lot of what we're saying, the gangs or the gang control areas, or even sometimes the government and the elites, they don't want to hear this. They don't want to have that message being circulated into the population. So we had to find ways of putting our message out there without endangering anybody. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have been seeing in the past years. Even the youth movements, they're working a lot on social media, on the internet, on the different platforms.
If you could also mention some of the challenges in doing that, even though they have to recalibrate what you're doing because of the security issues. But as you know, since as African people, we're very communal. Is it also been a challenge to having people not being able to meet as frequently as well?
Of course, it's a huge challenge. And not only is it a challenge, but also keeping people engaged virtually, it's much more difficult, because we are talking about a country where there is no access to electricity, you know, where internet plans, it costs money for people to be able to buy themselves a data plan. It costs money for them to have a phone, and then when they have the phone, they have to keep it charged to be connected. So the challenges are a lot, and you are missing the human aspect as well. You know, you can be having an online training about the fight against corruption, how to tackle corruption in the country. You would have 100% of your attendance connected, but it doesn't mean that you have 100% of their attention. And that human factor is missing, because as African people from African descent, we like the warm, we like the sharing with people, we like talking eye to eye and discussing and exchanging our point of views. So we still do activities where people can attend, but we do them in smaller numbers. And they are very spread. So it's whenever the country is a bit more calmer, or if such and such neighborhood, such and such city is much more calmer, then we try and do things. But it is a huge challenge, and it is really, it's a handicap, you know? What we would have been able to achieve in 1 month, 2 months, now it's taking us years to achieve it, because of the fact that you cannot go to the people and you cannot have that human factor and that warmth that in sharing the information and discussing and in building something together. You feel that people who are part of the movement with you, they are very far away because of the fact that you cannot see the people as often as you would like to see. And also because life happens, you know. When you live in a country like Haiti, that's where there is so much insecurity, many massacres, many rape, young people, the only thing that they have in mind is of fleeing this country, you know, leaving this country. So you are missing the essence of being proud of being Haitian, you know, the essence of being happy about being in this country, because life happens and so much it, injustice, and it is so unfair what's happening to Haitians that a lot of the time it's difficult to ask them to come to an activity, even if it is online. You know, you lose that engagement from people.
So, Felina, you just mentioned that one of the challenges is getting together more frequently and having that camaraderie. One of the things also that I thought in this current state, when you're not meeting face to face, do you also find that the issues of credibility of organizations, is that one of the other challenges you get to, that you're confronting, because you're not seeing people, you're not interacting as frequently, you're not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't say credibility of the organization, because the organizations, they still exist, you know, and they're still working. What we see that we are losing is members, you know, member engagement. Like when people can move freely, your location becomes a hub. See, your office becomes a hub where young people come, especially in Haiti, where access to the internet is limited, access to electricity is limited. So your office becomes a hub where young people, they come, they do their homework, they come to meet with other friends, they come to discuss different topics, and, you know, you keep the space alive, you know. So you have conferences, you have movies, you have artists playing, so that's what you lose. You lose that engagement from young people, from your members wanting to get things done. But I wouldn't question the credibility of the organization, because the projects are still alive and people are really going above and beyond to keep the projects alive. I'll give you an example. We have that citizenship education program around what's corruption, what's the cost of corruption, and how do you fight corruption and impunity. And towards the election, we're going to have another program that we are going to launch about what is democracy, why do we engage in democracy, why do we participate in democracy, and what's the election, what is the electoral process, and why do you vote, you see? So those programs, they are still very alive, but in the beginning, they were designed to be done in schools and in university. With the insecurity, school has been very much disturbed. So when the school owners or the responsible of the schools, they have school, they give you very little time. So we have to adjust that program and do a lot of the program in terms of videos, short movies, and audio. You see, we have to work with youth clubs. Well, we had designed the program originally to be exclusively in schools and university and college. Now we have to go and work with youth clubs. We have to go and work with sports clubs. You see, you have to become much more creative so that you can still have access to the teenagers and the first-time voters, but you have access to them in other sphere, in other communities. So now we work with church, we work with the Voodoo community, we work with sports, we work with women organizations, girls organizations. You see what I mean? The boys scouts. We that's what we have to do, become much more creative. It takes much more time, much more energy, and you really have to ask a lot from your volunteers. But you realize at the same time that you can get things done as long as you want to make it happen. So that's why I'm not going to say that we will. I'm not questioning the credibility. I know for a fact that you don't have that same engagement from your members, and that you have to become much more creative. Of course, you are limited into what you can do. Like one of the human rights organizations that I also work with is the RNDDH. Like it's when there is a massacre, RNDDH would be one of the first in the forefront after the massacre to be meeting with the population and then, you know, doing a census of who's there, who got killed, how did they get killed, can we see pictures, can we see, you see. Now you have much less access to the community. So it's going to take much more time for you to discover the truth and understand what happened and then publish your report. But eventually you will get it done because we become much more creative. It asks you to take a lot of risk as well, much more risk than what you would have been taking when the country was kind of functioning properly. But we get things done, and I wouldn't go as far as questioning the credibility of the organization. I would say that we are much more limited into the work that we can do in the communities, and we have to become much more creative so that we don't lose it all.
Okay, that's good to hear that there's this that this the credibility is not necessarily the that is impacting the work. That people are still being able to, under these constraints, being free to collaborate, even though this is very, it's very difficult situation, to say the least. And as we're talking about this situation, how much of the country is controlled by the gangs, which are we hear most of the impact in Port-au-Prince and the capital, but what is the control within the country of these gangs?
The capital is taken over by the gangs. I would say, honestly, maybe there's 10 to 15% of the capital that's not taken over by the gangs. So if you look at it on the map, all you see is red. The very little area where people can still function, because you cannot really move freely, because anything that can happen at any time is much more, it's getting smaller by the day. And then you have the other department, that's Thibonite, which is towards the north of the country. Almost 50% of that is also taken over by the gangs. And you have gangs presence in all of the departments. Sometimes it's very small in only one city. Sometimes it's many cities. Like in the northwest of the country, you have different cities that are taken over by the gangs. So you are seeing the gang violence and the gang movement more and more towards areas that were known as being quiet. And then day in, day out, you hear that there's been a kidnapping, there's been somebody who got shot, there's been someone who got killed, things that you wouldn't be hearing in the past. But the real impact of the gang violence is the fact that Haiti has always been a country where everything was centralized in Port-au-Prince, the capital. So that's where the government offices are, that's where the heart of the economy is, the few manufacturer and stuff that we have, that's where they are. The big companies, university, you name it, they are all in Port-au-Prince. So now, because the gangs have taken control of the major national road it means that what you are able to do in the country is very limited. And freedom of movement, so for the goods to move, for health and that kind of stuff, has become very limited. And we have seen steadily the gangs attacking not only the roads, but the ports, hospitals, everything that has to do with the health sector gets attacked and destroyed and burned. Everything that has to do with the security and safety of the territory, so the police, the army, it gets attacked, it gets burned. And more recently, even the telecommunication was attacked. And they attempted to burn it down, like the big towers that would give data and voice to all of the country, they have attacked that. So it's been public in the news, you know, public knowledge that's what we're seeing. So we're really seeing a mafia at work. And from our understanding, it is a lot of the drug cartels and all of the illicit trafficking towards guns and ammunition. And you see that there is kind of a framework where they want to take control over all of the important and vital sectors in the country. So whether it is the police, whether it is the communication, whether it is the health sector, whether it is the different ports and the airports so that they can control what's coming into the country, you see a pattern where there is a clear way to them wanting to take over all everything that the government should be controlling.
And do you see that these gangs, as you're saying, that they're trying to take over, are they taking over or are they already part of the state since they have so much interconnected with some of the key players within the system?
Well, obviously, Mwiza, like I always say, there is no country where you can see that level of violence and that level of chaos. And then the state wouldn't be involved in it, you know? It's only because they have partnered or they have been working with government officials and the economic mafia and the elites that they can be doing all of that they are doing, you know? That level of violence and that level of coordination that we are seeing that the gangs have, the only way for them to have it is because they have people inside of the government. It's the only way, you see? So they already have that power, but what we are seeing is that there is a need on their part to control even more of the country. Is it for them to be able to move their drug more freely in the country and towards Latin America and towards the States? I don't know. Is it for them to be able to move their guns and ammunition more freely towards the Latin America and the States and Mexico? It's probably what we're seeing happening. But it is obvious, and it's no rocket science, that for the level of violence and chaos and gang violence and attack towards the population, massacres, and the complete total lack of justice, it's complete impunity and corruption, it is obvious that they have ties with the elites, whether they are the economic elites or the political elites.
And of course, as we when we say the ties of the domestic elites, but there's also external forces, particularly
yes.
Haiti's experience when whenever there's this instability, there's always international community coming in.
Yes.
Some people would say under the guise of protection, but if you could expand it, because it's similar to what's happening in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where you have in the midst of the UN peacekeeping force, but there's still the exploitation and all of the violence against people in the Congo. How has the international community been sort of part of this issue, this problem?
Yeah, well, Haiti, believe it or not, there is an arm and ammunition embargo on Haiti from the U.S. And it's been in many reports that were published by the UN that 90%, if not more, of the guns and ammunition that are being trafficked and smuggled into Haiti are coming from the states. So the states have an embargo on us, but the states is still sending guns and ammunition by the thousands to us. They are smuggled into Haiti from the states. So that's where you start looking at the problem. And we have never seen in the past nor in recent days any decisions or any goodwill from the United States of America of controlling illicit trafficking of guns and ammunition into Haiti. Nothing at all. Something as simple as checking every shipment that's off to Haiti could have happened, you know, and it would have probably given real results, or at least make the illicit trafficking so much more difficult, but we're not seeing anything happening. So all we are seeing is the UN who came into Haiti, and it seems as if they're here forever and they're going to stay forever and nothing is going to get done. And the US asking for another mission, more guns, more violence into the territory. So it is in their interest, you know, it is in their interest. And it's very similar, yes, to what's happening in the Republic of Congo, but it's also very similar to what's happening in any given country where the UN has been present.
You're listening to a recent conversation with Valina Elisée Chalier, who's a member of Non Pap Domi in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. In the conversation, she unpacks the current challenges of grassroots mass movements mobilization efforts. The music in the background is Shouted Out by Patrice Rushen, and we play that remembering Patrice Rushen's birthday, which is September 30. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
I mean, I'm a huge fan of history, so I'm always digging and reading and trying to understand. I have yet to see a country where the UN was present that is today quiet and that is today at peace. Even country like Rwanda, after the genocide, what you are seeing is Rwanda being very much involved in the war that's happening at the border of Congo. Why is that? Because of the riches that the country has, very similar to what you're seeing happening in other countries. So the UN comes into your country, they never leave, and they come at a cost, a very high cost. And it is very similar to the US. The US came into Haiti as far as when we had to pay the debt that was imposed by France, and the US never left, you know, and they came officially in 1915 with the occupation, and they never left. And all they're doing is serving their own interests. There is a huge economy into keeping countries into chaos and into war situation. There is a large economy towards this, whether it's people who are selling guns, ammunition, legally and illegally, whether it is people from the humanitarian sector, whether it is people who have built whole careers on countries that are being preyed upon by the international community. There is a large economy towards this. And once you read and you try to understand what's happening in those countries who seems to never be able to find peace, you understand it's because a lot of foreign countries are making a lot of money out of the chaos that they keep in those countries.
So when you see that there's been this list of sanctions of who's who in the political and economic high places of Haiti, one even a former president by the United States putting sanctions, you don't see that as really, that's really more of a window dressing by the U.S. Policymakers?
Of course, that's what it is. Like the Michel Martelly, former president of Haiti, has been sanctioned because of his involvement into drug trafficking and so on. He has never been prosecuted. Now, when was the last time that we saw the U.S. putting sanctions against an individual for drug trafficking into U.S. territory and not prosecute that person? I mean, you don't even have to go very far. That's where it starts. And what people and what the mainstream medias are not mentioning is that a lot of the time, those elites that the U.S. are putting, or the U.N. are putting sanction against, they are U.S. Legal residents, or worse, U.S. citizens, or French citizens, or Canadian citizens. A lot of the time, they're not even Haitian citizens, you know? And sometimes they are representative from other countries' embassy, honorary consul. That's who they are, you know? But people don't talk about that fact. They don't talk about the fact that a lot of the time, in reality, it is foreigners coming into Haiti and bringing the chaos to Haiti and bringing the violence and bringing the Huni capitalism and bringing all of the illicit trafficking. They are responsible of all of those lives. I always say to people, there is no war in Haiti. There is no war in Haiti. There is extreme gang violence in Haiti. There is extreme gang violence because there's a group of people who have decided that us, the population, we do not deserve the right to live. And they can kill us. We still don't know why they are killing us. If you are looking at in the news and you're looking at the pictures and you're looking at the videos, you will realize that the neighborhoods that were destroyed, they are not the upper class neighborhoods. They are where the poorest of the poor lived. These are the people that they are preying upon. So it's because they have decided that we are not human beings and we don't deserve the right to live. So whatever those sanctions that the UN and the US are putting out, I mean, I'm never going to say no to sanctions because at least it shows that something is getting done. But we know that that something is not enough as long as it is not followed by justice. Because putting sanctions is cute, you know? But the real action, the action that's going to give result, is prosecuting people and putting people in prison. At one point in time, people are going to have to pay for their crimes. They're going to have to go to prison. And we have yet to see this happening in Haiti. For as long as nobody's going to get arrested, then it's going to continue being total impunity, you know?
And then, of course,
the ICE arrest, they don't count because it's just your current president kicking people that he doesn't want in his territory out. That's not addressing the violence in Haiti. That's not addressing the corruption, nor is it addressing the human crisis that we have.
And this, I was just saying also the other thing that the U.S. has been saying recently is they're proposing this gang suppression force, which is going to be presented by them. It's a resolution that's been drafted by the United States and Panama at the U.N. Do you also see that more of really like the continuation of outside, particularly U.S. militarization of Haiti? Because one has to remember 1915 and many other times when there's been U.S. military involvement in Haiti without not for the benefit of Haitians, but really trying to get U.S. interests secured.
Well, what I have been saying for many years now, and what I will continue to say, is that no country in the world can survive with outsourcing its security. As much energy and effort that's being put into designing a foreign occupation force for Haiti, there should be doubled that energy and money and effort put towards strengthening the Haitian police and the Haitian army. That's when I would be saying, okay, foreigners really want to help. The U.S. really wants to help. As long as I'm not going to see huge investments into Haitians' security force, Haitian territory safety force, it's always going to be a waste of people's time and energy and thinking that we're all stupid, an insult to our intelligence. Because no country in the world can survive with outsourcing their security. What we have said for the MSS is exactly what happened. We said many times that this was a catastrophe of epic proportion, that nothing was going to get done, that there would have been even more massacre and more territory lost. To take the word that the government like to use, you know, lost territories. That's exactly what happened. Kenya came in, people got killed, Kenyan got killed, nothing was done. The airport is closed. There are even more territory that's been taken over. Port-au-Prince is less than 10% of the territory that's not controlled by the gang, the capital area. More than 50% of Artimonite is taken over. Center department cut into part of it is taken over. And little, you know, fire in many other cities in the entire country. Much more massacres and very little investment into our own Haitian forces. So that new redesigned U.S. Gang suppression force, that's the way I see it as well. And there's that opacity about what that gang suppression is going to come. Is that gang suppression going to come and drop bombs over us and drop, I don't know, and start shooting from helicopters? How many kids are going to get killed? How many innocent people who don't have anywhere else to go and have to remain in those gang-infested neighborhoods are going to get killed? We don't know. It's always total opacity on the pretense that they are deciding for us and not with us. And it's always foreigners deciding for us. And it's always the same co-op politicians signing up on solutions for us. So as long as this is what's going to happen, us, the people, we are always going to be the victim. The huge victim of that Kenyan-led force is the population. We don't know how many in the population got killed. What we know is that constantly there are reports coming out from their side, you know, the UN publishing the reports showing how many innocent people were killed by the force or by the police. And like I said earlier, we have yet to see serious thoughts being given and serious investments being made into the police, but mostly the army, because the situation that we have today in Haiti is a military situation that needs an answer from the military. But we have not seen in recent years any decent or focused investment into our army. So in 10 years' time, Wiza, if we are still alive, we're going to be having that same conversation if this does not happen. And it's going to be even more worse, because any kid who's 20 years old today, all they have known is the chaos and the violence in Haiti. That's what we've been going through since the
2000,
you know?
Yeah, and as I said, the militarization has always been, to say the least, problematic. It's just been, it's not for the people. It's just continuation of the military-industrial complex, and that's why a lot of us are against these type of invasions. It was just like in 1915, this time around, this in the last few years, in the last few decades, in Haiti's case, and of course even in Congo's case, they've used the image of the UN peacekeeping apparatus to do that. And as you said, we saw incidents recently of people being killed by a drone.
Yes. Kids being killed. Yeah? Kids, not only people, but kids being killed by drones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something that leads to further destabilization. It's just, as we've seen before in many places, the military has been used to really destabilize these countries and to keep a certain group of people in power. And so
exactly.
What's some of the things that the grassroots movements are saying directly to critique this type of policy from people on the ground, not the international organization, but Haitian organizations on the ground?
Well, people on the ground are mostly saying what I have said, is that we had warned them that the MSS, the Kenya-led force, would be a disaster and a failure. Nobody listened. Because nobody ever listened to Haitians, you know.
Yeah, that's the multinational for all this. Multinational security support for it. Yeah, sorry.
Exactly. And it's proven to be a disaster, a waste of time, waste of money. More people got killed. And the people are saying in the streets, if that did not work, and we kept on telling them that it is not going to work, why do they think that some other evolution of that type of solution is going to work? So that's the word in the streets. And when we are saying that, and when people in the streets or the grassroots movements are saying that, we are not saying that we do not want cooperation, but we want cooperation that's going to be good for us, cooperation that's going to give results, and cooperation that's going to come with respect, not already made and already designed solutions that we know for a fact will not give results. Because we have been through more missions that we can count. Like in my lifetime in Haiti, all I have known since I was a teenager was intervention after intervention after intervention. I'm 45 years old today, and we're still talking about more intervention, foreign intervention, security intervention. Now it's gang suppression intervention. But the gangs are coming from somewhere. And there is a reason why they are so powerful today. Why aren't we addressing the root cause of the problem? And why are we never talking about providing Haiti with powerful Haitian security forces? Like, that never can be a topic on the table, you know? When you go to meetings where sometimes grassroots organizations are invited, if you bring up the topic of the army, you are looked upon like an anarchist or an extremist. While we are seeing that the gangs have military weapons, and what's happening in Haiti, it doesn't take you a PhD or any rocket science for you to understand that it is a military situation. Like, anybody in the streets is saying it. And what we are seeing happening is that people in the neighborhood are organizing themselves in brigades who have given themselves the means of protecting their neighborhood. What does that lead to? It leads directly to more illegal guns, more illegal ammunition, and those brigades who manage to arm themselves, they're not going to give away the gun. They will become probably the next gangs. So it's chaos because there is a complete lack of understanding about what's happening in Haiti. If I want to be nice, or if I want to say things bluntly, there is a desire of keeping Haiti into chaos because it fits the narrative that Black people can never do well. That's what it is at the end of the day.
There's a Ghanaian expression, is an accident according to plan.
Exactly.
Which is what I always say what happened in Congo, because as you said, there's these military interventions
under the guise of support. And that's why a lot of us are always against, like, you know, AFRICOM going in to the continent of Africa and things like that, because it's really continuing a perpetual, what is called neocolonialism, and the militarization of the continent, or the, and then of course in Katie's case, the African diaspora. But it's so you always, when I still keep looking at, what is, if this is happening, there's money is flowing somehow. What is the resources and flow out as this is happening? Because you have such a similar situation in Congo where you have the military industrial complex from abroad involved, but then at the same time, your resources are taken out somehow. Though it seems as chaotic, but it's really kind of a system. In Haiti's case, what is that, and how are organizations studying that and trying to alert people about that?
Well, what we are observing a lot in Haiti, and I'm not going to use the word study because access to information is very, very difficult and very limited in Haiti. And access to data and statistics is very limited. But what we are observing and seeing is that despite the chaotic situation, despite all of that violence, there is a lot of money that's being circulated in Haiti. And you can see that it is a lot of money laundering, you know. There are many multiple gas stations being opened. For example, well, the cost of fuel is up the roof, and day in, day out, in the past year, we are having outages. There's not enough fuel. Movement in the country is not freely, so people are really doing little traveling. But yet, you are seeing multiple, like an insane amount of gas stations in a country where you cannot move freely from a city to another. And then what you see is that a lot of tolls are being put in place by the gangs. So the gangs control a lot of cash money, and that cash money goes somewhere. It is used by them somehow.
You've just been listening to a portion of a conversation with activist Felina Elisée Chalier, who's a member of Non Pas Dormir, which means We Aren't Sleeping, and she's based in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Felina Elisée Chalier, in the conversation, unpacked the current challenges to grassroots mass movements' mobilization efforts. The full conversation will be available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Combeat, which means Working Together, by Les Frères Parents and the Never Brothers. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Mwiza Mutale. Up next is Headline News, which is followed by Sha'anana Hussein Al-Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East with a particular spotlight on the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Sojourner Truth with Nana Gainfi. And that's followed by Combeat Lakai with Eugenia Charles, which looks at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Koza and Funan Gonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW, particularly during our fall pledge drive, which begins on October 12th to October 25. And the closing song today is From Palais by Jude Orange, featuring Wadner Paysan. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. and stay safe.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Noah Portner. Today is Wednesday, October 1st, 2025. Here are some headlines. The first federal government shutdown since 2018 began today. During the shutdown, millions of federal employees, including some service members, could go without a paycheck. Hundreds of thousands, including airport security officers, air traffic controllers, and certain members of the military, will be deemed essential workers and told to come to work anyway. ICE agents will also go without pay. National parks could close, and the Smithsonian Museums also typically close within a few days. Monthly payments, including retirement, disability, and supplemental security income benefits, will continue during a shutdown, given they are funded by permanent appropriations. There is a deep uncertainty about how long the shutdown could last, given that lawmakers on Capitol Hill don't appear anywhere close to a compromise. Democratic leaders in Congress are demanding an expansion of enhanced Affordable Care Act premium tax credits as part of any government funding deal. The political pressure behind the shutdown remains unresolved, with Schumer and Trump as the two key figures in navigating a compromise. Yesterday, in a vote to fund the government through November, three Democrats broke with Schumer, siding with Republican senators. Angus King of Maine was one of these senators, and he described it as, quote, "one of the most difficult votes I've taken since I've been in the Senate," end quote. Senator King argued that shutting down the government would give Trump more power. Democrat leaders maintain that Trump is not serious about negotiating, and shutting down the government is one of the major cards they have to play. Here is House Minority Leader Jeffries on CNN this morning.
He's an unserious individual. The Republicans are unserious at this point. They have no interest in having a good faith conversation. And all of the behavior, erratic, unhinged behavior that we've seen subsequent to that White House meeting should suggest to the American people who actually is trying to drive us toward a government shutdown. We continue to say we're willing to have a bipartisan discussion to arrive at a spending agreement that meets the needs of the American people in terms of their health, public safety, and economic well-being, particularly as it relates to driving down the high cost of living, not allowing millions of Americans to experience dramatically increased healthcare premiums, co-pays, and deductibles. That's a reasonable position in defense of the quality of life of the American people.
Leader Jeffries' Republican counterpart, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, also addressed the press in what was almost a mirror argument.
The sad thing about it is that every single bit of this was entirely avoidable. Democrats could have worked with us in a bipartisan manner to avert this unnecessary and very harmful shutdown. But instead, they did something that is rather shocking to us. They prioritized taxpayer-funded benefits for illegal aliens over keeping the government open for American citizens.
As you can hear, Speaker Johnson and Minority Leader Jeffries' arguments are quite similar, namely that the other side refused to act reasonably. Schumer and Trump are still in a position to compromise, if they are so inclined. On Monday, President Trump unveiled a 20-point peace proposal for the war in Gaza. The proposal calls for immediate release of hostages and the demise of Hamas, while not really committing to a Palestinian state. Post-war Gaza would be ruled by a provisional government backed by foreign soldiers, most likely from neighboring Arab states. The proposal gives Israel incredible leeway after the war and allows them to set up a militarized perimeter around Gaza. Yesterday, Trump indicated that he would only give Hamas 3 or 4 days to consider the proposal. Although ill-defined, President Trump's proposal, sourced originally from conservative politician Tony Blair of the UK, has gained major traction among Arab